welcome to Future Talk, a discussion-based podcast all about the future of science and technology. Over the next few episodes, I will be joined by curious minds from a variety of backgrounds to talk about their personal visions of the future of these fields. In today's episode, I am joined by Dr. Sophie von Stumm. Sophie has a master's and PhD in psychology, and she's a professor, lecturer, scientist, and researcher. So welcome to Future Talk, Sophie.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now that you're here, I'm actually going to throw you and our listeners straight into the deep end because I've got a few questions for you. Firstly, if I could reveal how and when you'll die, would you like to know?
Tough call, but no. I would worry all the time about it and, is it now? Is it going to happen? Can I prevent it? So no, I'm far too neurotic for that.
Mm-hmm. Next question. There's someone out there who's your exact double, both physically and mentally. Would you want to get to know her?
Most definitely, yes. It's impossible. I do a lot of research with monozygotic twins. There is no such thing as a doppelganger. So yes, absolutely, I'm intrigued. I want to meet that person.
Mm-hmm. Final question. At one point in the past, you made a huge mistake that has and will completely change the future path of your life and career. Would you want to know what that was?
I'm very torn on this one. On the one hand, yes, absolutely, in order to avoid it at a future occasion. And on the other hand, I can't change it anymore. I can't go back. So what good is the knowledge going to be?
Okay, that's interesting that you've answered that way. I know I would have probably answered a little bit differently. And some of those things, I wondered whether you'd answer differently as well. But I know that today's topic is the beauty of ignorance, which links in to your particular vision for the future of science and technology. And off the bat, this is quite striking to me, because I know that this is about choosing to be consciously unaware of certain things. We're both scientists, and that can sound slightly counterintuitive, as one of the goals of science is to pursue truth and ask questions to find further truths and in some way open up new paths to explore. So with that being said, I'm very interested to hear your personal vision for the future in just a few words.
I really see the key to the beauty of ignorance in the importance of asking questions. And we can only ask questions if we are aware that we don't know and that there are things left to know and left to find out. And as contemporary science is structured today, it seems to me that we often overemphasize the importance of findings or insights or information that has already been gained. And what we tend to forget is it is more important for our progress, for the accumulation of knowledge, to acknowledge that we don't know and to ask the next important question and then to think about the methods that are necessary to answer that question.
Thank you very much, Sophie. I'm pretty sure everyone listening is familiar with the phrase, there's no such thing as a stupid question. I know I use it all the time, perhaps to justify asking many different potentially stupid questions to find out more. But on a more serious note, questions is precisely how we open up new pathways and avenues for answers, and we shouldn't shy away from making them. And especially as scientists, being able to make the right questions, even though none of them should be stupid, is paramount. So I'm quite interested in knowing, how do you come up with engaging questions? Do you have a preferred method or process?
I usually start with very simple questions. Start with what you know. Start asking about what you know. And from that, you very quickly arrive at the step where you stop knowing something, but you still have a very concise question and you know that you're missing a very concise piece of information. But that is the sort of trajectory, I believe, that you need to take in order to get to the bigger question that is behind things. It's very difficult to start with a big conceptual question up front because you haven't clarified where you were coming from in the first instance. And so, for example, when I discuss ideas with my students or we develop new research agendas, we usually start with very simple questions about the definition of the construct that we're thinking about. And when we all know that we agree on those definitions, we can take it a step further and ask, how are they related to one another? Mm-hmm. And part of that question we usually can answer because we have prior studies that have shown associations. And part of that question we cannot answer, but we know exactly which bit we are missing. And then we can develop specific hypotheses about the relationship of these contracts that haven't been studied yet. But the third step is then to come to the question, what will that tell us about who we are as individuals, how we behave, how we think, feel, and act? And that is really the bigger picture question behind everything.
Okay, so I want to take this and play around with it a little bit and throw the question back at you. How would you describe the biggest challenge that we have in science and technology currently?
Small question to warm me up, right? Science and technology each face big challenges, but I see them as somewhat separate. I think for science today, in particular for social science, we are facing something that is known as the replication crisis, and fundamentally has emerged as a result of overemphasizing findings. So what has happened is that a lot of the social science studies that we rely on to interpret our behavior and to predict what individuals are doing turn out to be not as solid and not as powerful as we would like them to be. And one reason for these studies being difficult to be confirmed by new research is that we have reward structures in science that emphasize significant findings. So in short, you can only publish something if you found something significantly to be associated.
That's very interesting and definitely very present in the life of academia. On the other hand, on some of our earlier questions, you said that you thought you'd prefer not to know, such as the very first question about whether you'd want to know if you were going to pass away and how that would happen. I'm interested, do you think there's a role of being courageous in embracing ignorance?
Oh, I don't know. I would say rather the opposite on that question. It's cowardice that you don't want to know. But I think it's a question that is very important in society today, and especially for us as individuals, as we are having increasingly powerful methods for the prediction of health outcomes. And I'm thinking in particular about the latest DNA-based methods in that regard. We can, for example, foretell what an individual's probability or likelihood is to suffer from dementia or Alzheimer's later in old age. And we don't have good ways of dealing with that. We cannot cure it so far. So do you want to know that or not? And usually people fall in two camps here, those who say, I want to know, I want to prepare. Even if it's inevitable, even if it's not beautiful, I want to know in advance so I can save up some money to make sure I get the care that I need when the time comes and I look after my children and I live my life to the fullest. And at the same time, there's people who say, I'd rather not, because I will be worried about it. And every time I forget somebody's name, I'll be like, oh my God, it's starting. And it will just make me miserable and wonder if I can escape that destiny. And I think we have to be compassionate about both perspectives. And I don't think one is necessarily braver or better than the other.
I think that's incredibly interesting, because I definitely feel I'd probably fall in the camp of, I would really like to know. And I know that this comes more from a personal fear of uncertainty, which I think is very common in people and probably in animals at large, because after all, the unknown is scary. There's an innate fear of that. It's why so many people are afraid of the dark, or they don't know what's there. And if you're thinking about an animal that needs to do specific things in order to survive and to reproduce, it's essential for them to be able to predict as best as possible what's going to happen, to choose the best outcome for themselves. So I suppose the conscious choice to not know something, I feel, would maybe play even more on the mind. And maybe there are ways of overcoming that personal fear separately.
That's a very good point. What you have to keep in mind with all this is that as individuals, we differ enormously in the extent to which we find comfort in knowing and in the extent to which we tolerate not knowing. And it's actually a personality trait, the tolerance for ambiguity. How much can you live with not knowing something? But as scientists, we score generally very high on that because ultimately we've gone into professional fields that live off not knowing and trying to find out something that is yet to be discovered.
And that's particularly interesting because just having this discussion and seeing this potential other side or perspective on justifying an answer on these particular topics, it would suggest that being able to see things from different angles or taking into account different points of view would be very important. So I'm also interested in knowing whether other themes could influence these questions, such as humanity, environmental change. Could these help in striking the balance between the challenges that science and technology face?
I think the challenges of science and technology really penetrate all areas of life and all scientific disciplines that we have currently established. I do think the acknowledgement of not knowing, for example, in the context of environmental sciences, because you just raised that, is a very important issue. And it seems to me that a lot of the debate around environmental issues and how to overcome them is already fraught from the beginning because people are very strict in their beliefs about what they know about environmental problems. And yet it turns out if you have something when people are so extremely polarized, with some saying the world is going down and the other saying pollution is nonsense, it doesn't really exist, or climate change doesn't exist, it is usually because we actually don't quite know. We are not very certain about what is true, and that leads to these extreme perspectives. And we can see that in all fields, in politics, in society, everywhere. So the challenges that we face in science and technology are really challenges that affect all fields of life.
I certainly agree there. I definitely find that people find it very hard to comprehend things that are on separate scales, whether it be processes that happen very quickly or that happen almost as an emergent property from lots of different people or across large periods of time. With that in mind, I'm quite interested in knowing, do you think the questions we ask in science are formulated correctly, or are there specific ways that we could make that process better?
That's a very good question. There is a professor at Columbia who teaches an entire seminar about what we don't know. And he invites famous professors across scientific disciplines. And the only rule is it's a 2-hour talk that everyone needs to give. They are not allowed to have any slides. And they're not allowed to talk about what they know or what they have done in their research. They need to talk about what they don't know and what they haven't done yet and all the mysteries that they can think of. And I think training like that would be helpful to make us more aware in how to ask the right questions, how to come to big questions, and ultimately what we really want to answer.
I do think that coming onto topics with a fresh perspective does quite often yield new pathways and perspective. I'm a young professional, so I'm about to finish my PhD.
Congratulations.
I know that you've done that. You're already an academic and you are touching upon something that I think is quite prevalent in the academic world, where groundbreaking results or highly positive results are often reported, whereas negative results aren't, and the furthering of one's personal scientific career can be greatly dictated by that. With that in mind, I was wondering whether you had any advice for any other young scientists or people who are interested in pursuing the academic world.
Well, I'm not going to lie, it can be quite frustrating, especially if you're building a large research project on the basis of prior findings and you struggle to replicate them or make sense of your own data. But ultimately, I am a scientist by heart, and I would recommend it to anyone because it is quite beautiful to make a living of asking questions and finding answers to them. It's a hugely enjoyable process. There's no field that is without problems. And ultimately, I would say that the replication crisis is probably good news because it will make us think about how to improve science in general, how to improve the professional structures that science is built on, and how to improve the scientific method that we are using these days to communicate our findings in the first instance.
I definitely think that will be a very fascinating shift, especially now as I see lots of scientific groups are able to collect more and more data and actually start with large data sets and then ask questions from there rather than the other way around. So I'm definitely very interested to see how this scientific revolution will play out.
Yes, that's a shift that has been happening over the past 20 or 30 years, that research is less theory-driven and more empirically-driven now. And people are in two minds about that, and it's not quite clear yet if the empiricism really gets us better truths or insights than the theory-driven approaches. But ultimately, we might have to leave both behind and find a third new way to do science successfully.
Brilliant. We are going to have to wrap up soon. But before we do, I do have one very last activity to play with you. So a little bit like the start, I'm going to ask you lots of questions and you're going to have to reply as quickly as you can.
Okay.
But they're going to be much less heavy, a lot easier.
Excellent.
Okay. 15 plus 6.
21.
75 plus 26.
This is going to be embarrassing. Can I opt out?
Nope.
it's 101?
Mm-hmm. 123 minus 4.
119.
2 times 3?
6.
And can you tell me a colour and a tool?
A colour, white, and a?
Tool.
Tool. Hammer.
Yeah. Now, that is pretty interesting. So I don't know if you've ever heard or come across this brain teaser before. Apparently, 98% of people who are asked to do this after quick fire questions will usually say red hammer. So you're not quite in the 98%. You came up with hammer, but you came up with a different colour.
But here's the question, why is that?
Personally, I think it's because it goes to show that our brain thinks in patterns, and the patterns or certain ways of thinking are ingrained in a more widespread manner in society. I think it is actually quite a helpful way of thinking because it lets you navigate the world quite quickly. So, for instance, if you're answering the quickfire questions that I just launched you here on Future Talk, it will allow you to answer pretty quickly without waiting a long time for a more thought out or drawn out answer, which from an evolutionary perspective, if you were responding to a threat or a novelty, it would allow you to respond quickly. Rather than remaining put. But a lot of this is also societally influenced because it's interesting that most people always converge on the same answer. And I think that highlights the importance of being able to break out of our usual thinking patterns and to try and come up with others, or at the very least be aware that we can fall into these patterns of thinking. So, Sophie, I was actually quite interested in knowing your take on this because I know you've researched personality development in the realm of curiosity and you're interested in differences between individuals. So I was wondering if you had any other brain teasers that you enjoyed and that you would recommend for training our curiosity.
In order to generate diversity in responses or inspire creative thinking processes, it's useful to break with the script. And silence can do that. So I always enjoy when teaching students or lecturing, and it happens every now and then that nobody pays attention or you ask a question and there's no reply. And you just take a moment and sit down and take a break. And students find that very unnerving, and they start wrestling around and they're like, ooh, we need to find an answer. And then they start thinking about the question for the first time. And it allows them to take a step back, reassess the situation, reevaluate the script and what is happening right now, and then think about the topic at hand.
That's particularly interesting. I used to volunteer on a listening helpline. So if people needed someone to talk to, or they were just having problems and they felt there was no one they could reach out to, they would call this number. And I remember one of the most important things was just giving people an extra few seconds of silence. So almost to the point where it seems awkward, but it will always trigger them to talk more, and quite often to even explore new potential solutions that they hadn't really come to think about by themselves. So it is very interesting that silence can have this power. Unfortunately, we do have to draw this to a close today. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on today, Sophie. Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and your vision with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Do join us in the next episode, where we'll be speaking to Future Institute Workshop CEO Andreas Steinle about how he believes social innovation will influence science and technology. Thank you so much for listening, and remember, stay curious.